Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the lineups for the Democratic presidential candidates debate scheduled on two nights on NBC, with the Orange Group first on Wednesday, June the 26th, featuring Elizabeth Warren, Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, John Delaney, Tulsi Gabbard, Julian Castro, Tim Ryan, Bill de Blasio, and Jay Inslee. Then the Purple Group on Thursday, June the 27th, with Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Kirsten Gillibrand, Michael Bennett, Eric Swalwell, Marianne Williamson, and Andrew Young. John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent, who has an article at The Nation, "The First Democratic Debates Shape Up as Unfair and Unfocused Spectacles," joins us to discuss his ideas for better ways to organize big multi-candidate debates going forward instead of 10 candidates on one stage over two nights trying to be heard over five moderators for 2 hours. He suggests a series of two-hour debates that put all of the candidates who meet a fair threshold on one stage where they are required to address issues such as climate change, immigration, reproductive rights, economic inequality, and criminal justice reform. Instead of the DNC format, he advocates for fair and functional discussions where good ideas will matter more than bad formatting. Then, with Secretary of State Pompeo today appearing on the Trump administration's Pravda, Fox News, signaling Iran, saying, quote, "President Trump had done everything he can to avoid war. We don't want war." We will speak with Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. He joins us to discuss how we got to the current crisis because of Trump's obsession with Obama and his tearing up of the P5+1 agreement with Iran, which has led to the current state of economic warfare with Iran that is unlikely to lead to a diplomatic solution, since Iran will retaliate asymmetrically with sneak attacks to drive up the price of oil, which Trump wants to avoid heading into the 2020 elections. Then finally, with the Trump administration again stealing a march on the Democrats in digital advertising for the 2020 elections, as they did in 2016, we will speak with Mark Bartholomew, a professor of law at the University of Buffalo School of Law, where he specializes in advertising law, cyber law, and intellectual property. The author of Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing, he joins us to discuss the political advantages of digital advertising, which gives campaigns more bang for the buck, along with providing valuable data for micro-targeting issues aimed at key demographic groups. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who was The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and the author, with Robert McChesney, of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. And his latest book is Horsemen of the Trump Apocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And he has an article at The Nation, "The First Democratic Debates Shape Up as Unfair and Unfocused Spectacles." Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
Ian, it's great to be with you.
Well, thank you, John. And already, of course, with the NBC decided who's going to be on. I guess it was the luck of the draw in terms of the splitting up the field of 20 into 10 per night. But already a couple of candidates, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, and Seth Moulton, missed the pick. And yet you've got people like John Delaney, who most people haven't heard of, Bill de Blasio, who's incredibly unpopular in New York, where he's the mayor in New York City. And then you've got Eric Swalwell, Marianne Williamson, Andrew Yang. I frankly wonder why these people are doing it. I know why they're doing it, to promote their brands, just as Trump did, at least in the case of Marianne Williamson, with her motivational Gurinoids following her, and Andrew Yang, of course, being a internet entrepreneur. John Delaney, I don't know anything about him, but it just strikes me as just so random. How do you? I know you've got some solutions here, which I want to talk about. But let's just start with commenting on this. I can't use the word. It starts with cluster and ends with a four-letter word.
Well, I think that's a let's just say chaos. Look, the as you suggest, the Democrats had a drawing on Friday where candidates could come in and they drew out of a hat and you figured out what debate stage you're going to be on. Now, to get to that point, you had to have met a couple of baseline thresholds, 1% in three polls, raise a certain amount of money in small donations. And there are two ways to look at this. One is the small d democratizing concept that you make it very easy to get on the debate stage. So basically anybody who puts an effort in this digital age, can meet the standard, right? I mean, if it's a contribution level of, a certain number of contributions, you send out a lot of the right targeted emails, texts, use Facebook, use Twitter, use other vehicles, and you get there. So we've got 20 candidates who got there, and they're divided onto two stages. And we see the crisis right up front, because you're going to have two 10-candidate debates night after night. On one stage, you have four of the front-running candidates for president of the United States: Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders. And these are people who really are kind of going at each other, not in picking on one another per se, but really going at it to try and position and move up, right? And then you've got the fifth candidate who is in that upper tier, Elizabeth Warren, over on the other night. And so instead of having your major contenders, in the same space going at one another with some, effort to, show who's better at it, you've got this separate zone. And let me give you some measure of how different these two stages are. If you add up all of the polling support for the candidates in the debate that features Sanders, Biden, Buttigieg, Harris, obviously six others, it comes to 65%, right? If you go over to the debate that's got Warren and nine others, it comes to around 20%. So you see where the weighting, one of these is kind of the big ticket night, and the other one's sort of this other game. And of the 20% on that Warren stage, basically half of it, more than half of it, is Warren, right? So maybe she does so well on her one night, right, that she really flies on that. Or maybe she gets dragged down into a debate with, all these other folks trying to, Beto O'Rourke is on that stage, so is Cory Booker and others who are trying to get a position. But the real attention goes to the other night. And then it's also this kind of fundamental question of, are you really having a debate when you've got your serious contenders for the presidency of the United States on separate stages? This isn't like what the Republicans did 4 years ago. 4 years ago, for better or worse, the Republicans had a main stage, and then they did have a stage for the people who were at the lower places in the polls. It was called a kiddie table, and that was a mess as well. I'm not arguing necessarily for that model, but I will say, at the very least, on the Republican side, 4 years ago, they had their major contenders on the same stage. The Democrats, later this month, will not have that.
And again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who's the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He is the author of his latest book with John Robert McChesney, is Horseman of the Trumpocalypse, I should say, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. And he has an article at The Nation, The First Democratic Debates Shape Up as Unfair and Unfocused Spectacles. And as you mentioned, one of the ways to get to qualify is to simply, as Cory Booker has done, which is call upon his supporters to just donate $1 either through Facebook or Twitter or whatever other means. And he's got to the threshold. But the other problem that you've pointed out in your article at The Nation, John Nichols, is that you've got five moderators. And yeah. I can't see.
Divided up between the two. I think it's going to be three a night.
Right. You know? Right.
But imagine that. You've got 10 candidates. And I'll tell you a little secret, Ian, about politics. Politicians like to be heard. They like to, you know, put themselves forward. And so they're all kind of elbowing to claim as much of the mic time as they can. And then you've got three moderators who, again, I'm going to let you in on a secret, you know, TV anchors tend to have a bit of an ego and want to talk as well. So you got 13 people on the stage each night, all trying to fill a 120 minutes. And I'm just going to tell you what's going to happen here. On the night where Warren is debating, and I'm going to suggest that she, Beto O'Rourke, and Cory Booker get a disproportional amount of time. On the night that Sanders, Buttigieg, Harris, and Biden are debating, I'm just going to suggest those four get a disproportional amount of time. Now, here's where the conundrum comes in. You are going to have all these other candidates on. If you give a fair distribution of the time to each candidate, which I understand and respect that model, it's just there's no way that you're going to really hear anywhere near the level of discourse that you would want to have, right? It's going to and it's going to have one other crisis, which I guarantee will occur. I promise you this, having watched debates for a very long time. It's going to be of the moment of the momentism, because the people who are anchoring are going to want to make headlines, right? So they're going to say, well, the president just tweeted this, or the president just said that, right? And they're going to ask them all to respond to it. And so you're going to eat up, I promise you, you will eat up substantial amounts of time with them all saying, yeah, Donald Trump is a bad guy. We know that. We agree on that. But these debates are set up in a way where I can almost guarantee you that substantive discussion that might actually help us to distinguish between these candidates is going to be way dialed down. And style, that ability to say something outrageous, to grab a moment, that's going to be way dialed up. And that's fine. I mean, I understand style matters to some extent. But boy, at this early stage where we're trying to sort through the candidates, my suggestion is that because of the way this is arranged, the luck of the draw, which stage you end up on, and, you know, this style is going to matter more than substantive opinions on fundamental issues.
Well, your idea, John Nichols, is to have these two-hour debates with all the candidates that meet a fair threshold on the stage together, and then over a series of nights, you have, for example, climate change, immigration, reproductive rights, economic equality, criminal justice reform, and a number of other subjects as the themes. But what I like about your suggestion is, for example, on the climate change night, you would have questioners like AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's got the Green New Deal, and I assume, you know, you could balance her with a more conservative person. That would be so much more interesting, at least to my mind, where you'd really be digging deep, you know?
Right. And so what the DNC is going to do late in June when they have these two nights of debate, they're going to take 240 minutes, right? 240 minutes. And they're divided between two debates with these, you know, big crowds of people going all over the place, bouncing around like a, you know, just like a ping pong ball.
Right. 10 minutes apiece, right, basically. Ten minutes is the best you could get.
Right. And lots of different issues flying all over. What if you had, let's say we raise the threshold a little bit. Say you raise the threshold to 2%, right, that you have 2% support, which, by the way, in most of the world is the threshold by which you would get, you know, if you had proportional representation, that's a low line threshold for, you know, getting into some political participation. So, but you can debate it. But let's say we make it 2%. Right off the bat, you're going to be down to about 8 or 9 candidates. That's reality, because there's a tremendous number of these candidates, de Blasio, people like that, that are polling literally at zero in most of our recent polls, or 0 to 1%. So then you have reduced it, and you've set a somewhat more practical threshold. But even if you had more candidates, if you then have a topic and you say, tonight it's about climate change, you go off topic, right? We're going to shut you down, right? This is the climate change debate. You need to seriously discuss it. In a case like that, again, let's say we had 9, 10 candidates, and let's say we did a 2-hour debate, they could each lay out a program, an agenda. They could be pressed aggressively on the issues. They could go at each other about what's best. Some people saying Green New Deal is the way to go. Others saying they've got an alternative route, Biden offering, you know, some compromises, other people being like Bernie Sanders, a much stronger line. But the bottom line, and then Jay Inslee, if he gets in, and he's at a lower level candidate, but a guy saying this has to be central to everything we do, could be a good, pretty good debate. And let's say the next night, you have a very serious debate about the future of the courts, right? And the debate is, how will you make Supreme Court picks? Should we expand the size of the Supreme Court? You know, how should the courts kind of interact with Congress and the White House as regards, you know, where you legislate, how you legislate? But it's a serious discussion about the judiciary. You know, I will tell you, I guarantee you, that would be more interesting than what you're going to have.
Well, how do you
come away with real insight,
right,
to where the candidates are?
Well, how do you get around the problem? I mean, actually, Trump himself has broken the mold because he ran as a reality TV entertainer who was really interested, and Michael Cohen made this clear in his testimony. He apparently, throughout the campaign, he kept saying, this is the greatest thing for the Trump brand. We're just going to, you know, he really thought he was going to lose, and but gain a lot of attention, and the Trump brand would be exponentially more valuable. And he'd, in any case, he'd be running around the country leading a chance of lock her up.
He might actually be able to monetize it enough to make actual money.
Exactly.
Probably almost never done.
Right. Yeah. And also fulfill his obligations to Putin by making life miserable for Hillary Clinton. So had she won, which everybody expected. So that's the mold has been broken by him. So, you know, when you look at people like Marianne Williamson, who obviously has a long list of people who've signed up for her motivational courses, and there's endless sort of amounts of gurunoids out there. And then, you know, others, who are promoting their brand. Of course, all politicians are promoting themselves. How do you come up with a system to prevent the Trumps of this world, you know, horning in for other reasons than the serious nature of running for the presidency?
Well, by the nature of it, you don't prevent that. Hucksters have run for president forever, right? Mm-hmm. And frankly, I go across that Democratic stage, I will be willing to say to you that every person on that stage would be a better president than Donald Trump. And that, to my mind, you know, I think that I'll give them all their due. And say that everybody running is credible and functional or whatever you want to say. How do you make sure that you don't end up in sort of the absurd territory, the territory that Trump has staked out? The answer is to go deep, not to go broad. And so issue-focused debates moderated by prominent figures who are associated with those issues and have authority and perhaps, you know, co-moderated by somebody who got a big hammer to gavel people down when they go off topic. But the bottom line is issue-focused debate. That's where you really challenge these people, right? And you actually learn something. If it's a debate between, let's say, again, if you had, let's say you had, you know, a debate about abortion rights and reproductive rights, and I've argued that them should have one on that, and your moderator is Elise Hogue, from NARAL, and maybe one other somebody backing her up there, but somebody who really takes them through detailed questioning about how far they're going to go, what they're going to do. You have different models. Kamala Harris has begun to talk about using a lot of executive power. Other people have talked about other models. You get into judicial appointments in a setting like that. Now, I understand that there are some people who say, oh, well, nobody'd be interested in 2 hours of discussion on that. I disagree. I think actually the depth of it and the back and forth, maybe somebody does bring up Biden's past record and he makes his case and other people. I actually think it could be highly engaging. I strongly believe that. And somebody who's a huckster, somebody who's just fooling around, who's just gimmicking it, is not going to do as well in that setting, I promise you, right? Because they won't have the depth. They won't be able to answer the questions in a way that, you know, makes them functional in the discourse. And so I think there's a way to do this. And I also strongly emphasize, I don't have to be the person. My ideas don't have to be the ideas that you do. That's not my point. My point is that when you look at how these debates, these initial two debates, and by the way, they're talking about doing a dozen debates over the next,
God knows how long it's going to be, right? Right. Well, John, we've run out of time, I'm afraid. Which will be the case on these debates too.
Just like the debates, you're giving a perfect illustration.
I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it very much, John.
It's a great honor to be with you, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who's the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. His latest book, co-authored with Robert McChesney, is Horsemen of the Trump Apocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And he has an article at The Nation, The First Democratic Debates Shape Up as Unfair and Unfocused Spectacles. And we're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into whether anybody believes the serial liar Trump that he doesn't want war with Iran.
The dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, appearing on Fox News today, Sunday, that, of course, is pretty much the Pravda of the Trump administration, said that the U.S. believes it's unmistakable that Iran was responsible for the attacks on the tankers in the Gulf of Oman. But he went on to say President Trump has done everything he can to avoid war. We don't want war. So do you think that Trump is actually in charge now? Because there was a period a little while back where it seemed that like the National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State Pompeo had got out ahead of Trump and things got really dicey. The Iranians actually thought the U.S. was about to attack them, and they were making preparations, defensive preparations, which the U.S. overheads mistook for offensive preparations. And then, fortunately, things were able to calm down there with President Trump stepping up and basically saying he wanted to talk to the Iranian leader on the phone. So Trump seems to be in charge. Would you agree in terms of saying, I don't want a war? He's told his lieutenants not to be so bellicose.
I would agree, Ian, but I don't think that is any cause for reassurance and confidence that we won't be headed to war with Iran, for the simple and obvious reason that if the only thing preventing a war between the United States and Iran today is Donald Trump's maturity, political judgment, and sagacity, that doesn't leave a lot of room for confidence. My own view of what's happening is that Trump is reluctant to go to war, but he's surrounded by war hawks, not just John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, Rudolph Giuliani, but in the region, Donald Trump is very close to a number of governments that are fanatically pro-war, not just Benjamin Netanyahu, but also the Saudis and the Emiratis. And given what I understand Donald Trump's, you know, political judgment to be, if he can be convinced by his close advisors and his regional allies that going to war with Iran is to the benefit of his own political career, his possible reelection, then I suspect that he can be convinced. So we are in very dangerous waters. And I think we will be on, you know, tender hooks for the next year and a half until the next presidential election. So these are very dangerous days.
Well, a few days ago, I interviewed a founder of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the Iranian IRGC. And I asked him, because it seems pretty clear to me that this attack was carried out by the IRGC. So I asked him, what is their motive? And he said, first of all, they're not rogue. They work under the direction of the Supreme Leader, and that what the Iranian leadership wants, not Rouhani, but the real leaders, the Supreme Leader, they want some leverage. And every time they tweak the U.S., the price of oil goes up, which serves their purposes. So what do you think the Iranian motives are for making this incredibly provocative attack?
I would agree with that analysis, Ian. I think the strategy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, really for the last 40 years, has been to match threats with threats, match provocation with provocation. If the United States takes hostages, Iran will take hostages. If the United States tries to block Iran's sale of oil, Iran will then try to do the same in terms of preventing other regional countries from selling oil. So it's matching threats with threats. This is actually very similar to what's been taking place for a very long time. It's almost the same strategy that Iran has been pursuing with the arrest of foreign hostages, many of them dual nationals. Iran has at least half a dozen Americans in their jails, many Canadians, Europeans. And it does this as a way of trying to assert some leverage over the United States and the international community. So the oil tanker attacks, I think, can be understood and should be understood specifically within this context. It is a question of leverage, and Iran is trying to raise the cost on the United States and the international community for this policy that Donald Trump has pursued and is pursuing, that is trying to bring Iran to its knees and to possibly, you know, lead to perhaps a renegotiated nuclear agreement, or if John Bolton prevails, a regime change or regime collapse.
Via military action.
Via military action, right. So I think that's sort of in the cards. I mean, that's clearly the Bolton-Pompeo preference. It's the preference of the Emiratis, the Saudis, and the Israelis. But Donald Trump is, you know, as we just discussed, reluctant at least now to pursue a war option. But I think that's certainly within the realm of the possible over the next year and a half, if Trump can be convinced that, you know, his ego or his reelection prospects would benefit from some sort of military confrontation with Iran.
And something that really irritates me a lot, Nada, is the coverage that we get that is jingoistic and right across the board. For example, in the coverage that we're hearing about Sudan, there's very little reference to the reason that these military thugs are resisting democracy and murdering the people in Sudan who've lived under dictatorship for decades and are now tasting freedom. The reason that these thug reactionary generals are holding on to power and killing civilians, pro-democracy civilians, is because they have the backing of Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis. And after all, the Sudanese mercenaries, the military, are fighting on behalf of the Emiratis and the Saudis in Yemen, because the Saudis and the Emiratis don't really have an army that's worth a damn. So they're hiring these mercenaries. So that's the reality. None of that is ever publicized in our press, because we know the Saudis spend an awful lot of money in Washington, and it's just shocking how effective they are. And it's equally true here in this context about Iran. Nobody is talking about the fact that the United States has declared economic warfare on Iran. It's not dissimilar to what happened prior to Pearl Harbor with the Japanese, when Roosevelt cut off their oil supplies they had to figure out, we've only got so much oil, it's going to last us 6 months, and we're going to have to grab the oil in Sumatra and Brunei. Otherwise, we run out of energy. So I'm not making excuses for the Japanese, and I'm not making excuses for the Iranians, but I'm just saying that if you put yourself in their shoes, it does look very different.
Well, I would agree, Ian. I think the key point here with respect to the current crisis with Iran is that we have to acknowledge how we have arrived at this particular point where it seems like we're on the verge of war. The context of this current crisis is a direct result of the policies that Donald Trump has pursued since becoming president. It's exactly as a direct result of the tearing up of the Iran nuclear agreement and the attempt to pursue this policy of maximum pressure, which has then, you know, produced a predictable series of events that we have all been observing over the last several weeks. Just to, you know, highlight the point, it would be inconceivable that under another American president such as Barack Obama, who I was not a huge fan of, but that we would be, you know, in this particular moment of crisis. And all of this can be traced back to, you know, the policies of the Trump administration, which, you know, as we discussed briefly, there's more than one Iran policy. I think for Trump, it's very much about, you know, his deep obsession with Barack Obama and the fact that the Iran nuclear agreement has Obama's name on it and Trump wanting to tear that up. I'm almost certain that he never read the nuclear agreement and is, you know, unfamiliar with its specifics, but he wants a new deal where he can sort of lay claim and have his name on it. But of course, his close foreign policy advisors have, I think, a much more ambitious agenda, and it's their, you know, narrative on Iran, and it's his new policy under the Trump administration that has set the context and set the stage for what looks like another war in the Middle East led by the United States. So these are very difficult and depressing times.
Well, there's no question that the record is clear to justify what you just said, Nad Hashemi. But Trump is so out of his depth and so out of control, and it's all about him and his personality and him looking good. He's trying to do now with Iran what he did with North Korea. He starts out with fire and fury, and everybody's concerned that he's going to provoke a war, a nuclear war, on the Korean Peninsula. And now he talks about these love letters and how he's in love with Kim Jong-un and what a beautiful letters that they exchanged, etc. I don't think that's going to work with the Supreme Leader. I mean, the Supreme Leader absolutely set up Abe, the Japanese Prime Minister, just the very simultaneously when these tankers were attacked, one of which was a Japanese tanker. He's sitting down with Abe, and he ambushes him with a television interview where he berates Abe on camera for the Iranian audience and basically says, if you're an emissary from Trump, bringing a letter from Trump, I don't want to talk to you. And here, Abe looks like, you know, a deer in the headlights. So what's going on there? I mean, what's the strategy of striking a Japanese tanker at the same time humiliating the Japanese prime minister?
Well, that's a great question. I think from the perspective of Iran's supreme leader, ideologically, he is against any sort of dialogue or negotiation with the United States. In fact, I would argue that this new tough line by the Trump administration, by Bolton and Pompeo, has actually been a godsend for Iranian hardliners because it allows them to, you know, justify and advance an ideological narrative that they've been pursuing for a very long time, that the United States cannot be negotiated with. The United States is Iran's eternal enemy. And just look what, you know, just look what they're doing. So they can just point to American policy today. And of course, this puts Iranian reformists, Iranian Democrats in a very difficult position because they're in favor of dialogue. They're in favor of, you know, engagement with the international community. So, you know, all of these policies, once again, that the United States is pursuing is having the exact opposite effect. You know, contrary to, you know, what we're hearing from Bolton and from Pompeo, that this, you know, tough policy is going to lead to regime change, it's actually having the exact opposite effect. It's actually strengthening the regime. It's strengthening their narrative. It's allowing the Revolutionary Guard Corps to actually benefit economically via these smuggling networks that they have, via their extensive patron-clientel systems that will be, that will be relaunched in order to strengthen their stranglehold over the economy. So I think that, you know, the Supreme Leader's position is basically to talk tough against the Americans, to resist any sort of suggestion of diplomacy or dialogue, and then to just, you know, wait and see what happens over the next year and a half and see if there's, you know, some sort of advantage that Iran can't pursue somewhere down the road. I think that's fundamentally what's happening. That explains the recent humiliating posture that the Supreme Leader revealed with respect to the visit from the Japanese Prime Minister. And so every way you look at this crisis, Ian, you know, you see that all of the most reactionary forces in the region are being strengthened. And of course, the more moderate and democratic oriented forces, both in Iran and the broader region, are being undermined by these policies.
Well, given the fact that Iran is absolutely devastated under these economic sanctions, this economic warfare that the U.S. conducting, particularly cutting off their supplies to international capital and transactions on SWIFT, they're in terrible trouble. So the IRGC, of course, has been targeted as a terrorist group in this escalation that's coming on from our side. And is there any way that you can get rid of this horrible government? I mean, it's the Iranian people, almost 90% of them, just loathe this religious kleptocracy led by this family. By the way, Khamenei, the supreme leader, wants his dreadful son, Mujtaba, to become the next leader. That's going to be incredibly unpopular. So is there anything that the people can do? Because you've written about it the last time they rose up, the people reloaded, the Green Movement and the struggle for Iran's future. They got murdered, and the besieged militia is out there in the streets already harassing people. So what are the options for the Iranian people? I mean, obviously, if the U.S. attacks in any form, they will rally around the flag, and that would be completely counterproductive. So is there a strategy here where you can support the Iranian people and not reward this dreadful government, which you've already pointed out, that there's a symbiosis between the hawks on our side and the hawks on their side?
Well, I think, you know, that's a great question, Ian. It's a great question also to ask on the 10th anniversary of the, you know, the Green Movement protests, which took place exactly 10 years ago at this moment. I think the answer to the question in terms of how to help the struggle for democracy in Iran is, number one, you have to listen to very closely what Iranian democratic forces are telling us and asking from the international community. And if you do listen to them, number one, they'll say that the best help that the international community can provide in terms of supporting the forces for democracy in Iran today is to, number one, completely reject and resist this hawkish policy of crippling sanctions and threats that we're seeing from the United States, to try and get the United States to sign back onto the Iran nuclear deal, and to engage in much more systematic and effective, you know, economic relations with Iran, which will help the Iranian middle class economically so that they don't have to do what they're doing right now, and that's basically struggling to survive. I think the answer to the question, Ian, first of all, is that there's, number one, we have to be clear, there's no quick fixes here. The Islamic Republic of Iran is not going to be toppled overnight. If you believe in a strategy of nonviolent resistance, that demands patience, it demands a long-term strategy. But the international context, you know, is incredibly important. So is the regional context. And unfortunately, you know, when you look at Iran's international context for democracy and you look at the regional context, it really doesn't favor the forces of democracy in Iran, because there's an impending, you know, possible war on the horizon. And in all political contexts, when you have the threat of war, that, you know, supports and that benefits hardliners, conservative forces, people who want to invoke national security arguments. It doesn't help the forces of democracy. But of course, on top of that, you know, you have these, you know, as you mentioned, crippling economic sanctions, where, you know, the strategy for most Iranians who are in the middle class, young people, is simply try to survive economically. So the way forward, I think, is really to try and get to a situation where the threat or the fog of war is lifted over Iran, where there is, I think, much better internal economic circumstances for the average Iranian citizen, where then people can then start to think about mobilization and organization.
As opposed to survival. It's the same problem that the opposition in Venezuela have. They're just starving. And people who are starving under an oppressive regime simply can't mobilize, and And the same is true in Zimbabwe, which has been going on there for decades. So despots can hold on and people can suffer enormously for decades. And that is one of the sad facts of life, I'm afraid. And I thank you for joining us, Nader Hashemi.
Thank you, Ian. Appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into how the Trump administration stole a march on the Democrats in 2016 with digital advertising, and they're doing the same thing for the 2020 elections.
Things want, and why are they here?
You still don't get it, do you, boy?
They have recruited the rich and the powerful.
They're running the whole show.
Wake up! They're all about you, all around you. Blinded us to the truth.
Take a look. They are safe as long as they are not discovered.
I don't know what they are or where they came from, but we gotta stop them.
I don't like this one bit.
We have been lulled into a trance.
Listen to what I'm saying to you.
We're in trouble. The whole world's in trouble.
Control us!
You're sending some kind of secrets out of TV sets.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Bartholomew, who's a professor at the University of Buffalo School of Law, where he specializes in advertising law, cyber law, and intellectual property, with an emphasis on copyright, trademarks, advertising regulation, and online privacy. His latest book is Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Bartholomew.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So I guess our political candidates are products to be marketed. One of the great paradoxes of our democracy is that our representatives are essentially being turned into telemarketers who spend most of their days dialing for dollars and very little of their time legislating. And then all of this money, or most of this money, is then turned over to the major media oligopolies, particularly in the swing states. And it makes people like Rupert Murdoch rich. And in fact, Rupert Murdoch isn't busily buying up TV assets in these swing states because he's rolling in cash from his sale of his entertainment assets from Fox, having sold them to Disney. So that is a brief sketch of the political landscape. So as a specialist on advertising, do you see political candidates as products to be marketed?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's becoming more and more so. I think you can trace a line starting in maybe the late 70s, 1980s, to we're more and more with the same person who's selling soap or shampoo for Procter & Gamble. The same kind of techniques are being leveraged to sell us political candidates, and that's a difference. Of course, you know, image has always been important. Flashy images have always been important, but there's been always a sense that political advertising should be different. There is more of an attention to rational faculties and policy positions, and we see less and less of that. When you see interviews with the people who are guiding these political campaigns, they admit this freely, at least when they're not talking to broad audiences, that what we're trying to do is leverage that same kind of thinking that goes into picking out a soft drink or a sports car.
Well, one of the most appalling things that I found out from a couple of Republican and Democratic strategists who'd done some major campaigns, presidential campaigns, I had them at a debate a while back at UCLA, and they both said the same thing, that towards the end of the campaign, literally in the last few days, is when a huge number of Americans, I can't remember the percentage, finally pay attention to the campaign that's been going on for, about 2 years prior to then, as we can witness from the moment, since we're saturated and the Democratic debates are coming up very soon. So what they were saying was that these so-called low-information voters who haven't been paying attention, only pay attention in the last few days, is kind of frightening, that that's the swing vote. inattentive, non-participatory, indifferent Americans are the ones that, at the end of the day, decide.
It is, and I've seen those statistics, too, about how people not really tuning in to the very end of the campaign, which I think is probably hard for, you know, people like you and myself to believe, since we follow these things fairly closely early on. But I also think there's a competing tension here that I can just mention, because I think you wanted to talk about the digital advertising for these campaigns in particular today. And that's when we're selling things, whether it's candidates or commercial goods, advertisers really try to rely on low attention. In some way, it's their best friend. And what they'll do is just try to almost subconsciously have us have a sense of association with a brand name that they can leverage later on when they make the more transparent, rational appeal to someone. So if we don't really pay attention, but we see out of the periphery information about, you know, Coke or Pepsi or BMW, and then later on when we're interested in shopping for a car, we already have that rosy association. That's what the advertisers are trying to do. And I think today with political campaigns, we're seeing a lot of that in the digital space. That I thought, well, the low-level social media user will see these messages about candidates and issues, and maybe they won't pay a lot of attention, but just by seeing them out of the corner of their eye, that plants a seed that can be harvested later on, maybe when we're talking about those last few weeks of the campaign.
So let's talk about how the Republicans have stolen the march on the Democrats in terms of digital advertising. And we know from the 2016 election that Brad Pascal, the media guy, I guess he is, for Trump, who got the job because he was the lowest bidder on, I think, advertising Trump's wine or his vineyard in Virginia. But he turned out to be very skilled. He actually had Facebook people working for the campaign. Apparently the Democrats, or Hillary Clinton, didn't want the Facebook people, but it turned out to be they got a much more bang for the buck, didn't they, the Republicans, or the Trump campaign in 2016. Hillary Clinton took the old-fashioned route of spending a lot of money on TV ads, and instead the Republicans or the Trump campaign targeted those three important swing states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan with targeted social media ads, with the help, of course, of Russian trolls and, of course, Cambridge Analytica as well. So I'm astounded that the LA Times had a front page story about this the other day. I'm astounded that the Democrats are lagging again. Didn't they learn their lesson from 2016?
Right. And, you know, in trying to think about how we should feel about 2016, I think there's a couple of things to put in play here. And here I'm putting on my scholar of advertising hat. One is that it's really just hard to know how effective the Brad Pascal Facebook messaging was. There's this famous quote by a department store magnate in the 19th century, and he said, "Half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. The trouble is I don't know which half." And so we can see that Trump eventually won and these things happened. And so maybe Brad Pascal is a genius, and it seems like the Democrats are missing out. On the other hand, we just don't know how effective it is. But I think there are some things that we should feel are disturbing about this and different from other scenarios in the past. And that's with regard to the nature of digital advertising. So, you know, one thing is just, it's not like Trump just has the advantage of messaging people before the Democrats do. You know, maybe we could live with that because we can put our message forward later if you're the eventual Democrat nominee. But all this advertising and social media is also a means of data collection. So the Republicans don't just have a head start with messaging. They have a head start with getting more and more sophisticated lists of voters, people who potentially respond to fundraising efforts, to rallies that can be used later on. And that's an important informational advantage. And then the other thing I'll mention here is what's different about, say, a candidate getting a head start in the past with some political ads out there is that this kind of spending on digital advertising allows for tremendous volume. So it's not just like you're sending a few television commercials out there. You're sending thousands and thousands of ads to thousands and thousands of different potential voters, and you're testing. You're seeing, well, does this color work better than this color? Or does this picture of Trump work better than this picture? And you're also gaining capacity to do this subtly, If you have that many advertisements, you can slowly change things. And, you know, in the commercial space, we see things like this where advertisers slowly change the texture and the nature of a website. So people don't even really realize it's being changed to become more effective. And so I think this head start and all this, you know, advance in money spent by the Republicans so far should make us a little bit concerned, particularly if you're a progressive voter, about having advantages in these areas of data collection and just sheer volume.
So when you mentioned the department store owner from, was it the 19th century?
Right.
Who said, you know, I know I'm wasting half of my money on advertising, I'm just not sure which half. Does that apply to Facebook's business model? Because I recall when Mark Zuckerberg testified to the Senate, the senator from the long-serving senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch, naively asked, how do you make your money? And of course, Zuckerberg said, well, from advertising. So the fact that Facebook and Google basically soak up all the digital advertising dollars and have essentially have monopolies, has anybody really tested whether or not the advertiser is getting their money's worth?
So they try to, and it's somewhat hard, I think, for me to believe, at least, that when you look at the, you know, the billions of dollars that are spent on digital advertising, and like you say, 85% of it is spent on just two companies, Facebook and Google, that there isn't more kind of proof positive what advertisers are getting for their money. But actually, the whole process is not very transparent. There's been some examples of kind of middlemen getting involved and then just having bots pretty much click on these advertisements to fake that there are results here. So I do think that the Wanamaker, you know, well, I spend this money advertising, I'm not sure that I'm getting for it, still applies, right? We're not quite sure how effective Facebook and Google advertising is, but, you know, because of these things I mentioned, just that it's different than just putting something out there in the ether and seeing if it persuades people. You're collecting data on people. You're running thousands of simultaneous experiments to see just what color or image is the most persuasive on people, that we should at least be concerned that this kind of political advertising is more effective than what we've had in the past.
Well, one of the things that's become very obvious and evident about Facebook is that they don't want to take responsibility for anything that they publish, although they don't say they're publishers. They try to see themselves as sort of utilities, like a phone company, where they're not responsible for what people discuss on the phone. And there are moves underway to force them to accept more responsibility for what is shown on their platforms. And there have been some really pretty flagrant examples lately, particularly, for example, of Nancy Pelosi's deep fake video of her slurring and appearing to be drunk, and Facebook wouldn't take that down. Where do you think we're heading there? Because an artist recently made a deep fake video of Zuckerberg himself, and there's been a very effective one made by the movie director. Jordan Peele did an amazing deepfake video of Obama, where Obama's making his speech, which we recognize, and then suddenly he starts talking, you know, really weird stuff. And it's just so upsetting. And so, you know, and it was, he didn't made it deliberately to point out the inherent danger of deepfake. So Zuckerberg still, as far as I know, hasn't really moved on this. Look what's happening now with the U.S. and Iran in the Gulf. Can you imagine so much of the U.S. government's evidence about Iranian involvement in putting mines on those tankers comes from a drone shot of the IRGC guys on a boat taking a limpet mine off the hull, the unexploded limpet mine. And we know the Iranians are saying it's fake already, but given that the threshold has already been crossed, what can we believe anymore?
Right, right. The whole problem of deepfakes, I think, is going to get worse for a while before it gets better. And of course, you have this layered with an administration that has just told us to reject any talismans of what we should think is true or fake anymore, and just, you know, blindly kind of accept things on the basis of ideology as opposed to fact. And so that's a dangerous combination. As far as making Facebook liable for this stuff, that's a that's a tricky thing, right? And of course, you say Facebook has assumed, well, we're not responsible ever. We're a pass-through, even though if you look at other media properties like the New York Times, you know, they do have a certain responsibility to screen what's printed in their newspaper or put on their website. You know, I think Facebook is worried about this, and more broadly, I think they're worried about these issues with regard to political advertisements. If you had asked me a year ago whether Facebook would bend to public pressure, I'd say not really. They seem, you know, pretty immune to that. But something has changed recently. And in regard to political advertising, they have adopted strategies. They're not perfect. They're not everything we need. But they do now have visible archives of the political ads that are shown on Facebook. Some of these things used to be able to be run and then disappear immediately. Now we can go through the archives, see what's there. They're now requiring a certain amount of disclosure of who runs an advertisement on Facebook. Of course, you had to do this on print television. Now you actually have to do it on Facebook a lot now. So I'm encouraged that at least on some areas, they're taking steps to deal with these problems.
But why should the New York Times have to have batteries of lawyers and fact checkers and editors? And, you know, the same is true of the New Yorker, which is famous for its fact checking. And that's what you try to do in journalism. You try to only publish or broadcast what you can prove, not what you think. Everybody has opinions, but facts are hard to come by and you have to work at it. So why shouldn't Facebook work at their facts?
Right. And I think what Facebook would say, and their lawyers have said as well, we're not the journalists. We don't put our imprimatur on this. People just see it and they assume, well, it's somebody who posted it and you're supposed to take it for whatever it's worth, but Facebook isn't warranting this as news. On the other hand, you have American public, which roughly two-thirds of the American public gets their news from social media, so they are relying on, you know, what appears on their Facebook feeds often as their news, and so we need to worry about that. And I'm not sure where the balance lies, but what I can say is that for years, and not just Facebook, but other kind of internet players, Google as well, have gotten a free pass on this. There's something called the Communications Decency Act, an old law passed, you know, in the 90s, that said we really need to worry about preserving this as an open space. So we'll say nobody's liable online for things that are published by other parties. Maybe the poster itself can be liable, but not the intermediary, not Facebook, not Google. And I think that's created a situation that's delivered some problems and run a bit out of control. And I think that politicians, at least, are moving to soften or change some of this, you know, kind of get out of jail free card for entities like Facebook. And I think the public and even some of the Silicon Valley players are starting to get on board with this plan.
Well, just in closing, the political scientist Hannah Arendt wrote in the 1950s, "The ideal subject of an authoritarian regime is not a committed Nazi or Bolshevik, but someone for whom, quote, the distinction between fact and fiction, true and false, no longer exists." And that's certainly what we have in Putin's Russia and what we're beginning to have in Trump's America.
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Mark Bartholomew.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Bartholomew. He's a professor at the University of Buffalo School of Law, where he specializes in advertising law, cyber law, and intellectual property, with an emphasis on copyright, trademarks, advertising regulation, and online privacy. And his latest book is Ad Creep, The Case Against Modern Marketing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.